Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
I'm your host, Mary Spacuzza. I'm joined by reporter Bob Glauber and columnist Dan Weiss. We've got a busy show for you this week. We've got the latest from Washington, D.C. Senators have been sparring over President Trump's cabinet picks, and members of Wisconsin's congressional delegation have been weighing backing or breaking from President Trump. We'll take a look at that. We've also got Congressman Duffy stumbling and Governor Walker obviously looking to 2018, which we can see from some of his budget proposals. We look at funding schools with a couple of our crack education reporters. We've got winners and losers, as well as your questions. And first, we're actually going to go to a taped segment with Craig Gilbert, our D.C. bureau chief. And now I'm joined by Craig Gilbert to get the latest out of Washington, D.C. Thanks for joining us, Craig. Wanted to find out a little bit more about what's happening with the Senate confirmation hearings. What can you tell us?
So the Senate has confirmed 8 cabinet picks of Donald Trump so far. A lot of Democratic opposition. I mean, Tammy Baldwin, the Democratic senator from Wisconsin, has voted for exactly half of those 8 cabinet picks. She's voted for 4. She's opposed 4. And she's also announced her opposition to, I believe, 3 more upcoming that haven't had a vote yet. But she's pretty emblematic of the really sharp and broad level of dissent that Donald Trump's cabinet picks are eliciting from Democrats. I mean, this is partly kind of a reflection of the rising partisanship and polarization of the Senate. It's also probably a reflection of the change in rules, where now there's no longer a 60-vote bar. The Democrats got rid of that for cabinet picks. So it allows a president to make bolder cabinet picks, and it also allows Democrats to a freer hand in opposing them. In this case, Democrats know that they can't stop any of these people. The closest they came was Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, who had two Republicans dissented and voted against her. It was a 50-50 vote that, for the first time ever in history, had to be broken on a cabinet choice by a vice president.
And you're looking at Wisconsin's congressional delegation and what incentives they have or pressures to either side with or break from Trump. What can you tell us about what you're seeing?
Yeah, when you look over, move over from the Senate to the House, and we've got 5 Republican lawmakers and 3 Democratic lawmakers, and it's interesting when you look at how their districts voted for president. House Republicans have been very unified so far. It's early, but very unified behind Donald Trump. We may not see too many cracks in that unity for a while. One reason is Republican voters are very unified behind Donald Trump right now, even though he's underwater in terms of his approval ratings overall. He's got his best ever approval ratings from Republican voters. So if you're a Republican congressman, one fear in opposing Trump is bringing on the wrath of Republican voters and maybe inviting a primary challenge. But there are differences from district to district. I mean, this is the first presidential election I can ever remember where Jim Sensenbrenner's congressional district did not provide the best margins for a Republican president. In this case, Sean Duffy's did, which was reflects the huge shift in kind of rural areas toward Trump. So Jim Sensenbrenner maybe have a little more freedom than maybe he would have had in the past. Paul Ryan vastly outperformed Donald Trump in his district, and Donald Trump margin in Paul Ryan's district is the smallest of any Republican congressman. So Paul Ryan may have a little more latitude when it comes to Donald Trump, but he's also under heavy pressure as House Speaker to present a unified front. And finally, the one Democrat, Ron Kind in Wisconsin, whose district was carried by Donald Trump, one of only 12 Democrats in the country whose districts were carried by Donald Trump, faces an interesting set of cross pressures because, again, his district narrowly voted for Donald Trump. But Democrats in his district are going to pressure him to oppose Donald Trump at every turn. So he's he's probably the most cross-pressured lawmaker out there from the Wisconsin delegation.
Right. There are still some actually competitive congressional districts out there, I guess. Thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it. And talk to you
soon. Okay. Next time.
Thanks. So speaking of Washington, one of our congressmen did not have a great TV interview this week. He tried to talk about terrorism. It did not go well. Bill, can you tell us a little bit about what happened?
It was 12 minutes and 30 seconds. It probably seemed like 12 hours to Sean Duffy. He got in a big back and forth with a CNN host, made some rather provocative statements on terrorism. He got into a discussion on white terrorism. It showed really that he's not ready for prime time if he is going to run for the U.S. Senate. He got blowback from South Carolina, where they were having a discussion of the killings at the church down there, the black church, and he immediately said, well, some good things came out of it, and of course, really terrible things came out of it.
Isn't this supposed to be a strength? TV. I mean, he's former Mr. MTV guy and all of that.
Real World, Road Rules, you know,
right? All of those things. But you know, and he's been doing. Actually, I first saw him on election morning at 6 a.m. on CNN, I believe it was, and then another station. He's been doing a lot of TV as a surrogate for the Trump administration, and he's done okay in like 2 and 3 minute blocks. And it started off okay, but then it just seems like it was too long a segment for him to handle.
And he had to bring it on, I think he said, to
the host.
It was a very combative, I'm not sure why he chose the combative approach to the CNN host. Just about everything she said, he wanted to challenge it, and it ended up leading him into several rabbit holes that he didn't want to go down.
The other thing that's occurring here is, you know, everybody's lining up in Wisconsin among the Republican side for the 2018 Senate election against Tammy Baldwin.
And he's seen as a front runner.
Seen as a front runner. He was on the Trump train very early. He looks the part. He's from northern Wisconsin. He has a credible congressional record. And if he is to enter the race, one thing he would obviously try to do is clear the field. And, you know,
he didn't do that.
He did not do that.
The people who love this would be Eric Hovde, who loves this, and some of the other candidates who are looking at this.
So he has to raise his game. I think it was clearly a situation where he had to raise his game. It's kind of, Dan, you would know this as well as I do. It kind of reminded me of Ron Johnson in 2010, where you just did not know what was going to come out of the candidate's mouth.
He was actually more aggressive than Ron Johnson was back then. Ron Johnson was sort of, you know, he didn't have much to say, and he just said it again and again. And this one, Sean Duffy decided to adopt sort of a Trump persona by fighting back, and it led him to saying some weird stuff. There's the one line where he says, I'm a lover, and other stuff like that. I'm like, what is he doing?
And he also talked about the attack of the mosque being like a one-off event. And obviously here
which
in Wisconsin,
he said more than once, yeah.
We've had, you know, some horrible crimes committed by white nationalists in recent years. There was the temple shooting. Trooper Trevor Casper was killed by somebody who was a white supremacist and had some really...
And this obviously was the top of the front page in South Carolina because of what he said there, that a lot of good things had come out of the shooting.
Nikki Haley took down the Confederate flag, but obviously lives are lost. And that's
right. So you don't want to talk about the good things that come out of any mass shooting.
So moving next to Governor Walker's budget plans, were you surprised by anything that you saw out of his budget?
Well, we got to see his new theme for the next election, that we're working and winning for Wisconsin.
Right.
The big surprise, I think, was what he had to do on roads that's the tough spot right now, because some Republicans very beholden to the road builder industry, and they want to build roads and they're willing to pay for a gas tax increase. And Governor Walker keeps on saying, no, I'm not going to. So his budget includes more borrowing and putting off work on the East-West corridor right here. So
How are people responding to that here?
Well, Roads are very strange around Wisconsin. I'm not from Wisconsin originally, so
You've been here long enough.
I've been here long enough. But, you know, this is the bridge to nowhere kind of thing where it just stopped. And this is the place where they almost built a double-decker freeway years ago by the lakefront. I mean, crazy stuff. Mm-hmm. So now you've got this fight over what to do with the east-west freeway system. That's the part, you know, basically from the Marquette interchange to about 82nd
Street, to the zoo.
And it's a bottleneck. There's no question about it. The neighborhoods.
And they've done work on those two parts, the Marquette and the zoo, but not in between.
Yeah, and the neighborhood, Story Hill, they don't want anything to do with it. And you also have the cemeteries in the middle of all of this, you know, that you can't widen the road by the cemetery. So they've decided to halt it. But in come MMAC, the Chamber of Commerce, they want this project done, and they're going to still push for this project.
It's really high traffic.
It's high traffic, and they point to places like the Menominee Valley, the Brewers, Miller Coors, Joy Global, that they need this east-west system taken care of. It looks like it's going to be on the shelf, but I would never say never on this project. This thing is always going to come back until it's dead, and I don't think it will be.
So this has been a problem for a year now about funding for roads, and this budget address didn't resolve that, I don't think. I think it just brought that to the fore. The other surprising thing was that the governor put more money into public schools. He did put more money into charter and private and voucher schools, but also he did exactly what Tony Evers was asking for. What was it, 200 more per student in the budget? I think that was something of a surprise. Someone who's built his career cutting expenses and everything, Act 10, which was meant to reduce expenses in the schools, he brings this up. That was a big surprise to me.
I mean, it was interesting that he tied the funding to Act 10, so to get the money, you've got to comply with
Right, Act 10. And so then if they don't abide by Act 10, he can point the finger at them and say it's their fault that they didn't get the extra money. So, I mean, it's clever, maybe a little too clever, but I think those were the two big surprises from the budget address.
It was interesting. One of the Democratic senators called it a deathbed conversion, like he's looking to re-election and all of a sudden wants to be the school funding governor.
Yeah, I think this is an area where he's weak. People generally like their local schools. The vast majority of kids are not in private schools or in voucher schools or in charter schools. So he wants to shore up his support in that area, and I think in the suburbs, that's a very important thing for him to be tackling.
And so, you can also see, just, you know, he tweeted out a day before this speech what I would call a Morning in America ad about this budget. And I mean, you know, with the sort of the glossy shots of Wisconsin and the winning and working, or is it working and
working
winning?
Working and winning
and
for Wisconsin.
Yes.
And so, you know,
14 times in the speech.
And what sort of amazed me is, you know, you still have Democrats in the state who think he's not going to run for re-election. And to be quite honest, I don't know what they're looking at.
We had another tweet, actually, it was just like that said, you know, it's, what was
it? The future's too bright to stop being governor,
right,
sort of thing, with a little smiley face with the shades.
And he also addressed it more directly by saying if Hillary Clinton had won, he would not run for re-election, which leaves the question open that she didn't win. So he obviously can't run for president in 4 years. So, you know, the most obvious thing is for him to run again in 2 years.
So speaking of schools, we've actually got a taped segment that we just taped this morning with Aaron Richards and Karen Herzog. Governor Scott Walker unveiled his budget plan yesterday, and a lot of it had to do with schools and school funding. So I am joined by Karen Herzog, our higher education reporter, and Aaron Richards, education reporter, to talk a little bit about it. So what was in the plan for schools? And let's start with K-12.
So Governor Walker laid out one of the most ambitious school funding plans that we've seen, $650 million more proposed for K-12 schools around the state and a per-pupil aid increase in each year of the budget, a lot more support for rural schools, grants for rural schools to install new technology infrastructure, to train teachers. There's additional aid in the budget for a variety of other programs that have school officials pretty excited, but we learned yesterday in the governor's budget that massive aid increase for schools, which would be about $200 per pupil in the first year of the budget, another $200 in the second year, which really means a $400 increase in the second year of the budget, that would be tied to being in compliance with the Act 10 legislation, which means that, specifically, districts would have to have their school employees paying 12% of their health insurance premium costs. Not all districts in the state meet that threshold. Certainly Madison doesn't. I think their teachers are somewhere around 3% as an average. Milwaukee Public Schools has workers contributing between 2 and 14% of their health care costs because employees who get paid less pay less toward their health care. Teachers with higher salaries and administrators pay more. But this is going to be a new wrinkle. We've never seen an aid increase tied to sort of being in compliance in this way. So we're still digging on that today.
And obviously Act 10 was a really controversial proposal when he unveiled it in February 2011. It all but eliminated collective bargaining for most public employees in the state. Obviously, if you know, the protests showed that it was not a very popular proposal among public workers. So, yeah, I think we'll be reading and hearing more about that.
And you've seen districts like Kenosha where they have a clause in their employee handbook that requires conferring with the union before you make changes to the handbook. That's been a big battle to say, well, is this legal under Act 10? So we're still digging into that. And, you know, if districts have to mandate that all workers pay 12% of their health care costs to get the aid increase, it'll be really interesting to see, you know, what would happen down the road.
What about for higher ed? What was in the budget?
Well, the big buzzwords for higher ed this time are accountability and affordability. You look at the governor's budget, he's proposing a 5% tuition cut, which there's been a freeze for the last 4 years. He wants to continue the freeze into the fifth year. But a 5% tuition cut would need to then be backfilled with state taxpayer dollars. So taxpayer dollars would pay for the tuition cut to the tune of $35 million. Additionally, he has like $100 million in initiatives in the budget. $50 million of it is actually just putting money back that was allocated before, but that the UW system wasn't allowed to spend, referring to that as a lapse. So $42.5 million is what UW system asked for. But that's all going to be tied to performance-based measures for the first time if
and
it goes
how do you,
through.
How do you measure performance?
That's a very good question. In fact, UW system officials really aren't saying much about that because they don't know the broad measures like, you know, graduation rates, how long does it take to finish a degree, are you getting a job after you graduate, are they in high-demand fields. And also, this is a new wrinkle, too. He wants to see three-year degree programs for bachelor's degrees. The current degree programs having a format that would help students get through quicker, which there are a lot of questions about. How does one do that? What are you taking out? And does that risk accreditation for a four-year degree program if you're trying to squeeze it all into 3 years? There are a lot of different components to accountability and affordability.
And how are school officials responding to this, and is he getting any criticism from anybody?
Certainly. So, for the most part, district officials around the state have been cautiously optimistic about an increase in K-12 funding. Schools have been cutting a lot under the Walker budgets. In the past, Walker's put more money into the school funding formula, but he hasn't allowed districts to actually spend that money, so the money has just flowed through as tax relief. Districts, I think, have been pretty insistent toward their lawmakers that they really need some more resources to operate. We've seen more operational referenda around the state where taxpayers have had to vote to spend more to support their schools. So district officials are saying, thank you, we appreciate this extra, or the possibility of extra money. What we're chasing now is the reaction to, okay, if there's a clause attached to this money, how would that fly? And will other lawmakers support that? They'll still have a final say.
What about for higher ed? Any criticisms, or are people cautiously optimistic too?
Well, considering higher ed has been cut $362 million in the last 5 years, I think there's real satisfaction with the proposal for another $42.5 million. You know, obviously the performance-based measures are a question mark, but there are a lot of things to look at in this proposal and how it would affect campuses and students. You know, allowing students to opt out of some of the segregated fees that they pay. You know, what does that do to student organizations? There's also one measure that's going to be very controversial among faculty, and that is requiring them to track the number of hours they spend in the classroom. This whole idea of making sure that they're you know,
not slack enough.
They're teaching.
But how would that work with researchers who are doing research? I mean, that's a totally different writing and researching, and you know, those are key points to getting tenure.
Exactly, and that's really what the conversation is, because you have some people who you hire as researchers, and they get funding through their grants to pay their salaries, and this measure would reward instructors and faculty members who teach more.
And really, you've seen adjuncts fill in so many of those classes where they're doing the bulk of the classroom teaching, right, which frees up faculty to do other work. So that's an interesting proposal.
It kind of continues with this with the tenure battle last year, this whole notion of holding faculty accountable and faculty having tenure protections that some perceive as protections for, you know, job protection for life. And they're trying to bring into this, you know, more measures of how well are faculty doing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you both so much for your time. We'll be looking forward to more stories on the budget. Thanks.
Thank you.
So there were obviously a lot of candidates for winners and losers this week. We had to narrow it down to a few. So, Bill, who's your winner for the week?
There's a guy named Justin Vernon. He's a musician, goes by the band name of Bon Iver, and his Eau Claire Music Festival announced the lineup. It's a good lineup, Chance the Rapper, Paul Simon. It takes place in Eau Claire over Father's Day weekend. It's the third year, and he's really put together a great music festival that looks like it's going to be here for years to come. It's an extraordinary thing from a musician, so good for Justin.
To Paul Simon, Wilco, just amazing lineup, so...
Is that your winner, too?
No, it's not mine. No, but there are a lot of winners this week. I mean, we could have, like, James White for the Patriots, a Wisconsin grad. He had a great thing. But my winner was school choice and charter schools. It reminds me, I mean, obviously, they're a very close vote for DeVos to get approved, but it sort of reminds me of the old joke about what do you call the guy who finishes last in his medical school class. You call him doctor, and it doesn't matter. She's now secretary, and that's very much her focus. And in the state budget, Scott Walker office also put a lot of money, more money into charter schools and to voucher schools. So that's my winner this week.
So even though she had to have the vice president come and break
again,
the tie,
it doesn't matter. I mean, she's secretary
right,
and, you know, it's now her job to do with that, you know, to do what she wants to do with it. Mm-hmm. And now my loser.
Yes.
My loser is the communications team for the Trump, and we could do this almost every week since he was selected. But this week was just an amazing number of things that happened. Help me out with some of these. You had the.
I'm not going to help you out. That's
well,
like
you had Sean Spicer.
Sean Spicer.
I was just recently confused Orlando and Atlanta.
You like had three times, I think.
Kellyanne Conway. Promoting the clothing line for Ivanka, and
go
then
buy Ivanka stuff. I think,
and
was
then
the
Bowling Green Massacre last week by Kellyanne Conway. The fact that they can't find the communications director, and then Melissa McCarthy in what was probably the biggest thing on Saturday Night Live, acting portraying Sean Spicer in a way that it said that it shook up the White House. So an amazingly bad way.
We've reached a world of alternative facts when we have Melissa McCarthy imitating Sean Spicer being a major story and a major hit on Sean Spicer's credibility. I've never seen anything like this. No, none of us have ever seen anything
Tina Fey.
Like this. Yes.
Tina Fey had a similar effect. But, you know, the funny thing is the ratings this time right now are higher than they were even then. It's 20 years. You have to go back 20 years for SNL to have ratings like they do now.
And it's got to be a rough week for Sean Spicer when he's reading in the news about how Trump saw him as weak because he was portrayed by a woman. And for your new boss, that just can't be a comfortable position to be in.
My loser of the legislative Democrats. I mean, is there a more just irrelevant bunch than, you know, normally they would be called the opposition party. Now they appear just to be the observer party. They can't even play their Scott Walker bingo anymore.
They got a call out. Which was hilarious.
And, you know, I've never seen an opposition party in a democratic society. I've been over to, you know, societies in Eastern Europe, but I've never seen an opposition party in a democratic society so irrelevant to the process. They really, it's just just stunning to me.
So I'm going to post something this afternoon. The Republicans have put together their own bingo game for the Democrats in the legislature. So we'll see what that looks like.
So, well, enough questions from me. We've got some viewer questions to get to. And one is from a viewer who's asking about Governor Walker's upcoming cruise.
To Alaska.
Right.
In August. Yeah, we wrote about this week. He's got a cruise to Alaska. He's going to speak. It's a Christian cruise, conservative Christian, evangelical gospel singers, and the daughter of the founders of Chick-fil-A and so forth. And the question is, basically, there's an ethical question that comes along. Mm-hmm. Can you use your public office for a personal gain? The company that's put this together says that they want it to be a free cruise for both the governor and the first lady.
Didn't they say they wouldn't get paid?
They would not receive any money, but they would receive the value of this trip, which Sheriff Clark just went on one of these. He put the value of his for him and his wife at almost $10,000. So it's an important question. And the governor has turned over this issue to the ethics board to see how they resolve this.
The other part of that question was why we didn't write more about the Clinton Foundation. Obviously, he is the governor of Wisconsin, so we tend to focus more about
that,
him.
That, to me, seems to be a non sequitur, actually, because it's focused on what the governor is doing. The Clinton Foundation, very well known, very well reported by the national media. We ran some of the stories. So, I mean, that foundation... The problems facing that foundation were pretty well aired, so it seems a little stale to bring it up now.
And besides that, this is new with the governor. It's in August, and they just put the brochure out last week, so this is something that's completely different from that.
You know, and to be honest, the other thing is, a lot of times people question us about stories that are in the news that have been read in the news, and why don't you cover those stories? They have been in the news.
So we should write to
How did
send
you know about that?
Because
you read about it already.
So the next question, we'll throw to you. Where is Hillary Clinton these days? Why haven't we heard from her?
Oh, she's on Twitter. She's been tweeting support for the Women's March, for all sorts of things. I mean, she's doing what a losing candidate usually does, and that is stay out of the public eye. We didn't realize how snarky Chelsea Clinton was in some of her tweets. You know, she's come
she's
across
had some zingers.
With some zingers. So, I would say that the Clintons are they're not in the public eye, but I would say you'd probably have to keep your eye on them going forward. There had been rumors that Chelsea Clinton might be looking at a run for Congress in Westchester if one of the congresswomen up there retired. So I would say the Clintons are going to be around, just like the Bush family.
An eye on her Twitter account.
The one who seems to be enjoying life post the election is President Obama.
His vacation photos look great. I mean, I would be, what is he, like sailboarding or something?
Yeah, learning how to do that. Yeah, he seems to be enjoying himself, jumping in and criticizing Trump, jumping out and back on the water. So,
and it seems like a post-presidential life is going to be pretty good for Barack Obama.
See, I think I was reading a post comparing him to the nation's ex-boyfriend, if you're looking at his fun vacation photos, thinking, I'm fine, I don't need you. Okay, so what about Senator Schilling, County Executive Chris Abley, who both said they're not going to be running for governor. Someone is asking if they will change their minds and who might run in 2018.
I don't know Senator Schilling's thinking so much, but Chris Abley, someone I've written about a great deal. I think the fact that he lost his primary to Chris Larson and he had to spend $5 or $6 million to keep his seat, I think he's going to stay right where he is. And he's said this repeatedly, and with some politicians, you don't believe it because they don't seem very convincing. But I think I would be very surprised if he ran for governor in 2018.
I'll just jump in. Dane County Executive Parisi and Dana Walks, those are two of the people you should be looking for. Will they run for governor or not? They're more realistic choices.
And I think the issue for Chris Abley is, could he win a primary? Because he might be able to do pretty well in the general election because he's carved out this niche as being a conservative on finances, liberal on social issues. But yeah, I think the unions would not support him at all for governor.
Okay, well, that's all we have time for this week. Thanks, guys. Thank you for tuning in, and please check back with us next week.
Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.